Hello, I'm Richard Burnip, and this is the second part of the podcast about Conan Doyle and Christmas. And I was talking about Doyle and his wife Louise visiting Doyle's mother in Thornton in Lonsdale, up in the Yorkshire Pennines, at Christmas 1890. Now, they were doing a number of visits at a critical turning point, really, in Doyle's life. Having spent most of the 1880s in medical practice in Southsea on the south coast of England, Doyle had decided to give that up. His income as a general practitioner, working flat out and writing in his spare time, had levelled out. He couldn't enlarge his practice and change that aspect of his work, but he didn't want to give up all that hard-fought medical knowledge. So, encouraged by a surgeon who he became friendly with, Malcolm Morris, he decided to specialise. He decided to go to Vienna to attend lectures in the human eye and then come back to England and set himself up not in Hampshire again, but in London. And that was what he'd done. At the end of 1890, he closed down his practice and was given a farewell dinner by friends and colleagues in Southsea, including another local practitioner, Dr. James Watson, and he packed everything up. Called in on his way north to Birmingham to visit a doctor that he'd worked for many years before and kept in touch with, Dr. Hoare, visited his mother, and then went to Vienna. Doyle, as a teenager, had actually spent a year in Austria, not in Vienna, but in a beautiful little place called Feldkirch in the Vorarlberg, and his spoken German, as a result, was quite good. And there's some debate about exactly how many lectures he attends whilst he's in Vienna, because he writes a novel while he's out there, a short novel that he was commissioned to do. And, you know, that was good money quite quick. So he writes that very rapidly while he's out there. And he returns to England at the end of March 1891. And the turning point in his professional life is just ahead. I talked about Chambers' Journal and The Surgeon of Gaster Fell, which I'm going to read the second half of in a minute, appearing in it in December 1890, and how Chambers' Journal is really an echo from the past, in a sense, because it has no illustrations, it's a close, small type, two columns, quite unforgiving to read by candlelight. But at the same time that was being published, December 1890, a new magazine was hitting the newsstands just in time for Christmas, perfect time of year, to launch a new publication, George Newnes' The Strand magazine. And Newnes and his editor, Herbert Green of Smith, had produced in fairly short order a new illustrated monthly magazine, which was going to have something for everyone in it. It was going to have short stories, articles, puzzles, a children's story, interviews with famous people, portraits of celebrities. It was going to have a bit of everything, and the illustrations were the major selling point. While Doyle was in Vienna, one of his short stories, a random one that he'd written called The Voice of Science, was accepted by the Strand. They were actually very short of good, new, short stories in their first few months. And they were delighted to get Doyle's. And The Voice of Science appeared in their third issue. When Doyle gets back at the end of March 1891 and takes rooms in Montague Place, the back of the British Museum, and a share of a building at No. 2 Upper Wimpole Street, which became his consulting room, he has already had the idea and started putting it into effect of putting Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson into short story format, beginning with a scandal of Bohemia, as he originally called it, or a scandal in Bohemia, as we know it, and as it was published in The Strand. And that appeared in July 1891. And by that point, Doyle had written six short stories, which would take through to December. And by the autumn, it was very obvious to The Strand that Doyle's stories were, firstly, exceptional quality, and secondly, extremely popular, and they asked him to continue the series to write another 6 stories to make a dozen altogether. Doyle, by the end of October, was able to say that he'd written the first 2 of that next batch of 6. One of those stories was one of his own personal favourites, actually, The Speckled Band, celebrated Sherlock Holmes story. And the other was The Blue Carbuncle, the Sherlock Holmes Christmas story. When Doyle wrote that story, he knew exactly when it was going to be published. He knew that it would appear in the Strand magazine for January 1892. In other words, the magazine that would come out after Christmas. And that's why that famous story opens with Dr. Watson saying to us, "I had called upon my friend Sherlock Holmes upon the second morning after Christmas," which to the original readers would have had the lovely feel of Watson telling us, sharing with us, an adventure that had only happened a few days before. That's very much the sense of it. And The Blue Carbuncle is a great story by anybody's standards. And Doyle knew at that point that Sherlock Holmes was a success. By that point, also, he'd given up full-time medicine. He'd almost died in May 1891 with a terrible bout of influenza, and he decided to trust to writing. Well, his novel The White Company was being serialized at that point in the Cornhill magazine, and that was getting very good reviews. And although it's not as widely read as Sherlock Holmes today, it was hugely successful at the time. From a financial decision alone, Doyle's choice to concentrate on his writing and see if he can make a living just from that was incredibly successful, because in his first full year as a writer, he went from an income during medical practice of about £300 a year to an income of £1,500. And I think most of us, if we were told, "Oh, change your career, concentrate on what you're doing in your spare time, and your income will increase 5 times. Well, of course, many people would at least give that some thought. Doyle, of course, didn't know that was going to happen, but Sherlock Holmes was a big factor in it. Well, to return to The Surgeon of Gaster Fell, Doyle's Christmas offering, if you like, for December 1890, with the success of Sherlock Holmes just peeping over the horizon, if you like. I'm now going to read the 3rd and 4th chapters. These were published on the 20th of December and the 27th of December, and they conclude the story of Mr. Upperton's strange experiences out there on the bleak Pennine Moors. After which I shall say just a few words in conclusion. The Surgeon of Gaster Fell, Chapter 3. Of the Grey Cottage in the Glen. It was either on the 4th or the 5th day after I had taken possession of my cottage that I was astonished to hear footsteps upon the grass outside, quickly followed by a crack as from a stick upon the door. The explosion of an infernal machine would hardly have surprised or discomfited me more. I had hoped to have shaken off all intrusion forever, yet here was somebody beating at my door with as little ceremony as if it had been a village alehouse. Hot with anger, I flung down my book, withdrew the bolt just as my visitor had raised his stick to renew his rough application for admittance. He was a tall, powerful man, tawny bearded and deep-chested, clad in a loose-fitting suit of tweed, cut for comfort rather than elegance. As he stood in the shimmering sunlight, I took in every feature of his face: the large, fleshy nose, the steady blue eyes with their thick thatch of overhanging brows, the broad forehead, all knitted and lined with furrows, which were strangely at variance with his youthful bearing. In spite of his weather-stained felt hat and the coloured handkerchief slung round his brown, muscular neck, I could see at a glance he was a man of breeding and education. I had been prepared for some wandering shepherd or uncouth tramp, but this apparition fairly disconcerted me.
"You look astonished," said he with a smile. "Did you think, then, that you were the only man in the world with a taste for solitude? You see that there are other hermits in the wilderness besides yourself."
"Do you mean to say that you live here?" I asked, in no very conciliatory voice.
"Up yonder," he answered, tossing his head backwards. "I thought, as we were neighbours, Mr. Upperton, that I could not do less than look in and see if I could assist you in any way."
"Thank you," said I, coldly, standing with my hand upon the latch of the door. "I am a man of simple tastes, and you can do nothing for me. You have the advantage of me in knowing my name." He appeared to be chilled by my ungracious manner.
"I learned it from the masons who were at work here," he said. "As for me, I am a surgeon, the surgeon of Gaster Fell. That is the name I have gone by in these parts, and it serves as well as another."
"Not much room for a practice here," I observed.
"Not a soul except yourself for 5 miles on either side."
"You appear to have had need of some assistance yourself," I remarked, glancing at a broad white splash, as from the recent action of some powerful acid upon his sunburnt cheek.
"That is nothing," he answered curtly, turning his face half round to hide the mark. "I must get back, for I have a companion who is waiting for me. If I can ever do anything for you, pray let me know. You have only to follow the beck upwards for a mile or so to find my place. Have you a bolt on the inside of your door?"
"Yes," I answered, rather startled at this sudden question.
"Keep it bolted, then," he said. "The fell is a strange place. You never know who may be about. It is as well to be on the safe side. Goodbye."
He raised his hat, turned on his heel, and lounged away along the bank of the little stream. I was still standing with my hand upon the latch, gazing after my unexpected visitor, when I became aware of yet another dweller in the wilderness. Some little distance along the path which the stranger was taking, there lay a great grey boulder, and leaning against this was a small, wizened man who stood erect as the other approached and advanced to meet him. The two talked for a minute or more, the taller man nodding his head frequently in my direction, as though describing what had passed between us. They then walked on together and disappeared in a dip of the fell. Presently, I saw them ascending once more some rising ground farther on. My acquaintance had thrown his arm round his elderly friend, either from affection or from a desire to aid him up the steep incline. The square, burly figure and its shrivelled, meagre companion stood out against the skyline, and turning their faces, they looked back at me. At the sight, I slammed the door, lest they should be encouraged to return. But when I peeped from the window some minutes afterwards, I perceived that they were gone. For the remainder of the day, I strove in vain to recover that indifference to the world and its ways, which is essential to mental abstraction. Do what I would, my thoughts ran upon the solitary surgeon and his shrivelled companion. What did he mean by his question as to my bolt? And how came it that the last words of Eva Cameron were to the same sinister effect? Again and again I speculated as to what train of causes could have led two men so dissimilar in age and appearance to dwell together on the wild, inhospitable fells. Were they, like myself, immersed in some engrossing study? Or could it be that a companionship in crime had forced them from the haunts of men? Some cause there must be, and that a potent one, to induce the man of education to turn to such an existence. It was only now that I began to realise that the crowd of the city is infinitely less disturbing than the unit of the country. All day I bent over the Egyptian papyrus upon which I was engaged, but neither the subtle reasonings of the ancient philosopher of Memphis, nor the mystic meaning which lay in his pages, could raise my mind from the things of earth. Evening was drawing in before I threw my work aside in despair.
My heart was bitter against this man for his intrusion. Standing by the beck which purled past the door of my cabin, I cooled my heated brow and thought the matter over. Clearly it was the small mystery hanging over these neighbours of mine which had caused my mind to run so persistently on them. That cleared up, they would no longer cause an obstacle to my studies. What was to hinder me, then, from walking in the direction of their dwelling and observing for myself, without permitting them to suspect my presence, what manner of men they might be? Doubtless their mode of life would be found to admit of some simple and prosaic explanation. In any case, the evening was fine, and a walk would be bracing for mind and body. Lighting my pipe, I set off over the moors in the direction which they had taken. The sun lay low and red in the west, flushing the heather with a deeper pink, and mottling the broad heaven with every hue, from the palest green at the zenith to the richest crimson along the far horizon. It might have been the great palette upon which the world painter had mixed his primeval colours. On either side, the giant peaks of Ingleborough and Penigent looked down upon the grey, melancholy country which stretches between them. As I advanced, the rude fells ranged themselves upon right and left, forming a well-defined valley, down the centre of which meandered the little brooklet. On either side, parallel lines of grey rock marked the level of some ancient glacier, the moraine of which had formed the broken ground about my dwelling. Ragged boulders, precipitous scarps, and twisted fantastic rocks all bore witness to the terrible power of the old ice field, and showed where its frosty fingers had ripped and rent the solid limestones. About halfway down this wild glen, there stood a small clump of gnarled and stunted oak trees. From behind these, a thin, dark column of smoke rose into the still evening air. Clearly this marked the position of my neighbour's house. Trending away to the left, I was able to gain the shelter of a line of rocks, and so reach a spot from which I could command a view of the building without exposing myself to any risk of being observed. It was a small, slate-covered cottage, hardly larger than the boulders among which it lay. Like my own cabin, it showed signs of having been constructed for the use of some shepherd, but unlike mine, no pains had been taken by the tenants to improve and enlarge it. Two little peeping windows, a cracked and weather-beaten door, and a discoloured barrel for catching the rainwater were the only external objects from which I might draw deductions as to the dwellers within. Yet even in these there was food for thought, for as I drew nearer, still concealing myself behind the ridge, I saw that thick bars of iron covered the windows, while the rude door was all slashed and plated with the same metal. These strange precautions, together with the wild surroundings and unbroken solitude, gave an indescribably ill omen and fearsome character to the solitary building. Thrusting my pipe into my pocket, I crawled upon my hands and knees through the gorse and ferns until I was within 100 yards of my neighbour's door. There, finding that I could not approach nearer without fear of detection, I crouched down and set myself to watch. I had hardly settled into my hiding place when the door of the cottage swung open, and the man who had introduced himself to me as the surgeon of Gasterfell came out, bareheaded, with a spade in his hands. In front of the door there was a small cultivated patch containing potatoes, peas, and other forms of green stuff, and here he proceeded to busy himself, trimming, weeding, and arranging, singing the while in a powerful, though not very musical, voice. He was all engrossed in his work with his back to the cottage, when there emerged from the half-open door the same shadowy, attenuated creature whom I had seen in the morning. I could perceive now that he was a man of 60, wrinkled, bent, and feeble, with sparse, grizzled hair and long, colourless face. With a cringing sidelong gait, he shuffled towards his companion, who was unconscious of his approach until he was close upon him. His light footfall, or his breathing may have finally given notice of his proximity, for the worker sprang round and faced him. Each made a quick step towards the other, as though in greeting, and then, even now I feel the horror of the instant, the tall man rushed upon and knocked his companion to the earth, then, whipping up his body, ran with great speed over the intervening ground and disappeared with his burden into the house. Case-hardened as I was by my varied life, the suddenness and violence of the thing made me shudder. The man's age, his feeble frame, his humble and deprecating manner all cried shame against the deed. So hot was my anger that I was on the point of striding up to the cabin unarmed as I was, when the sound of voices from within showed me that the victim had recovered. The sun had sunk behind the horizon, and all was grey save a red feather in the cap of Penny Gent. Secure in the failing light, I approached near and strained my ears to catch what was passing. I could hear the high, querulous voice of the elder man and the deep, rough monotone of his assailant, mixed with a strange metallic jangling and clanking. Presently the surgeon came out, locking the door behind him, and stamped up and down in the twilight, pulling at his hair and brandishing his arms like a man demented. Then he set off, walking rapidly up the valley, and I soon lost sight of him among the rocks. When the sound of his feet had died away in the distance, I drew nearer to the cottage. The prisoner within was still pouring forth a stream of words, and moaning from time to time like a man in pain. These words resolved themselves as I approached into prayers, shrill, voluble prayers, pattered forth with the intense earnestness of one who sees impending an imminent danger. There was to me something inexpressibly awesome in this gush of solemn entreaty from the lonely sufferer, meant for no human ear, and jarring upon the silence of the night. I was still pondering whether I should mix myself in the affair or not, when I heard in the distance the sound of the surgeon's returning footfall. At that, I drew myself up quickly by the iron bars and glanced in through the diamond-paned window. The interior of the cottage was lit up by a lurid glow coming from what I afterwards discovered to be a chemical furnace. By its rich light I could distinguish a great litter of retorts, test tubes, and condensers, which sparkled over the table and threw strange, grotesque shadows on the wall. On the farther side of the room was a wooden framework resembling a large hen coop, and in this, still absorbed in prayer, knelt the man whose voice I heard. The red glow beating upon his upturned face made it stand out from the shadow like a painting from Rembrandt, showing up every wrinkle upon the parchment-like skin. I had but time for a fleeting glance, then, dropping from the window, I made off through the rocks and the heather, nor slackened my speed until I found myself back in my cabin once more. There I threw myself upon my couch, more disturbed and shaken than I had ever thought to feel again. Long into the watches of the night I tossed and tumbled on my uneasy pillow. A strange theory had framed itself within me, suggested by the elaborate scientific apparatus which I had seen. Could it be that this surgeon had some profound and unholy experiments on hand, which necessitated the taking, or at least the tampering with, the life of his companion? Such a supposition would account for the loneliness of his life, but how could I reconcile it with the close friendship which had appeared to exist between the pair no longer ago than that very morning? Was it grief or madness which had made the man tear his hair and wring his hands when he emerged from the cabin? And sweet Eva Cameron, was she also a partner to this sombre business? Was it to my grim neighbours that she made her strange nocturnal journeys? And if so, what bond could there be to unite so strangely assorted a trio? Try as I might, I could come to no satisfactory conclusion upon these points. When at last I dropped into a troubled slumber, it was only to see once more in my dreams the strange episodes of the evening, and to wake at dawn, unrefreshed and weary. Such doubts as I might have had as to whether I had indeed seen my former fellow lodger upon the night of the thunderstorm were finally resolved that morning. Strolling along down the path which led to the fell, I saw in one spot where the ground was soft the impressions of a foot, the small, dainty foot of a well-booted woman. That tiny heel and high instep could have belonged to none other than my companion of Kirby Malhouse. I followed her trail for some distance till it lost itself among hard and stony ground, but it still pointed, as far as I could discern it, to the lonely and ill-omened cottage. What power could there be to draw this tender girl through wind and rain and darkness across the fearsome moors to that strange rendezvous? But why should I let my mind run upon such things? Had I not prided myself that I lived a life of my own, beyond the sphere of my fellow mortals? Were all my plans and my resolutions to be shaken because the ways of life of my neighbours were strange to me? It was unworthy. It was puerile. By constant and unremitting effort, I set myself to cast out these distracting influences and to return to my former calm. It was no easy task. But after some days, during which I never stirred from my cottage, I had almost succeeded in regaining my peace of mind, when a fresh incident whirled my thoughts back into their old channel. I have said that a little beck flowed down the valley and past my very door. A week or so after the doings which I have described, I was seated by my window when I perceived something white drifting slowly down the stream. My first thought was that it was a drowning sheep, but picking up my stick, I strolled to the bank and hooked it ashore. On examination, it proved to be a large sheet, torn and tattered, with the initials J.C. in the corner. What gave it its sinister significance, however, was that from hem to hem it was all dabbled and discoloured with blood. In parts where the water had soaked it, this was but a discoloration, while in others the stains showed they were of recent origin. I shuddered as I gazed at it. It could but have come from the lonely cottage in the glen. What dark and violent deed had left this gruesome trace behind it? I had flattered myself that the human family was as nothing to me, and yet my whole being was absorbed now in curiosity and resentment. How could I remain neutral when such things were doing within a mile of me? I felt that the old Adam was too strong in me and that I must solve this mystery. Shutting the door of my cabin behind me, I set off up the glen in the direction of the surgeon's cabin. I had not gone far before I perceived the very man himself. He was walking rapidly along the hillside, beating the furze bushes with a cudgel and bellowing like a madman. Indeed, at the sight of him, the doubts as to his sanity which had risen in my mind were strengthened and confirmed. As he approached, I noticed that his left arm was suspended in a sling. On perceiving me, he stood irresolute, as though uncertain whether to come over to me or not. I had no desire for an interview with him, however, so I hurried past him, on which he continued on his way, still shouting and striking about with his club. When he had disappeared over the fells, I made my way down to his cottage, determined to find some clue to what had occurred. I was surprised, on reaching it, to find the iron-plated door flung wide open. The ground immediately outside it was marked with the signs of a struggle. The chemical apparatus within and the furniture were all dashed about and shattered. Most suggestive of all, the sinister wooden cage was stained with blood marks, and its unfortunate occupant had disappeared. My heart was heavy for the little man, for I was assured I should never see him in this world more. There were many grey cairns of stones scattered over the valley. I ran my eye over them, and wondered which of them concealed the traces of this last act which ended the long tragedy. There was nothing in the cabin to throw any light upon the identity of my neighbours. The room was stuffed with chemicals and delicate philosophical instruments. In one corner, a small bookcase contained a choice selection of works of science. In another was a pile of geological specimens collected from the limestone. My eye ran rapidly over these details, but I had no time to make a more thorough examination, for I feared lest the surgeon should return and find me there. Leaving the cottage, I hastened homewards with a weight at my heart. A nameless shadow hung over the lonely gorge, the heavy shadow of unexpiated crime, making the grim fells look grimmer and the wild moors more dreary and forbidding. My mind wavered whether I should send to Lancaster to acquaint the police of what I had seen. My thoughts recoiled at the prospect of becoming a witness in a cause célèbre, and having an overbusy counsel or an officious press peeping and prying into my own modes of life. Was it for this I had stolen away from my fellow mortals and settled in these lonely wilds? The thought of publicity was repugnant to me. It was best, perhaps, to wait and watch without taking any decided step until I had come to a more definite conclusion as to what I had heard. I caught no glimpse of the surgeon upon my homeward journey, but when I reached my cottage, I was astonished and indignant to find that somebody had entered it in my absence. Boxes had been pulled out from under the bed, the curtains disarranged, the chairs drawn out from the wall. Even my study had not been safe from this rough intruder, for the prints of a heavy boot were plainly visible on the ebony black carpet. I am not a patient man at the best of times, but this invasion and systematic examination of my household effects stirred up every drop of gall in my composition. Swearing under my breath, I took my old cavalry sabre down from its nail and passed my finger along the edge. There was a great notch in the centre, where it had jarred up against the collarbone of a Bavarian artilleryman the day we beat Van der Tann back from Orléans. It was still sharp enough, however, to be serviceable. I placed it at the head of my bed, within reach of my arm, ready to give a keen greeting to the next uninvited visitor who might arrive. Chapter 4. Of the Man Who Came in the Night. The night set in gusty and tempestuous, and the moon was all girt with ragged clouds. The wind blew in melancholy gusts, sobbing and sighing over the moor, and settling all the gorse bushes a-groaning. From time to time a little sputter of rain pattered up against the window pane. I sat until near midnight, glancing over the fragment on immortality by Iamblichus, the Alexandrian Platonist, of whom the Emperor Julian said that he was posterior to Plato in time, but not in genius. At last, shutting up my book, I opened my door and took a last look at the dreary fell and still more dreary sky. As I protruded my head, a swoop of wind caught me and sent the red ashes of my pipe sparkling and dancing through the darkness. At the same moment, the moon shone brilliantly out from between two clouds, and I saw, sitting on the hillside, not 200 yards from my door, the man who called himself the surgeon of Gaster Fell. He was squatted among the heather, his elbows upon his knees and his chin resting upon his hands, as motionless as a stone, with his gaze fixed steadily upon the door of my dwelling. At the sight of this ill-omened sentinel, a chill of horror and of fear shot through me, for his gloomy and mysterious associations had cast a glamour round the man, and the hour and place were in keeping with his sinister presence. In a moment, however, A manly glow of resentment and self-confidence drove this petty emotion from my mind, and I strode fearlessly in his direction. He rose as I approached, and faced me with the moon shining on his grave bearded face and glittering on his eyeballs. "What is the meaning of this?" I cried as I came up on him. "What right have you to play the spy on me?" I could see the flush of anger rise on his face.
"Your stay in the country has made you forget your manners," he said. "The moor is free to all."
"You will say next that my house is free to all," I said hotly. "You have had the impertinence to ransack it in my absence this afternoon." He started, and his features showed the most intense excitement.
"I swear to you that I had no hand in it," he cried. "I have never set foot in your house in my life. Oh, sir, sir, if you will but believe me, there is a danger hanging over you, and you would do well to be careful."
"I have had enough of you," I said. "I saw the coward blow you struck when you thought no human eye rested upon you. I have been to your cottage, too, and know all that it has to tell. If there is law in England, you shall hang for what you have done. As to me, I am an old soldier, sir, and I am armed. I shall not fasten my door, but if you or any other villain attempt to cross my threshold, it shall be at your own risk."
With these words, I swung round upon my heel and strode into my cabin. When I looked back at him from the door, he was still looking at me, a gloomy figure among the heather, with his head sunk low upon his breast. I slept fitfully all that night, but I heard no more of this strange sentinel without, nor was he to be seen when I looked out in the morning. For 2 days the wind freshened and increased with constant squalls of rain, until on the third night the most furious storm was raging which I can ever recollect in England. The thunder roared and rattled overhead, while the incessant lightning flashes illuminated the heavens. The wind blew intermittently, now sobbing away into a calm and then of a sudden beating and howling at my window pane until the glasses rattled in their frames. The air was charged with electricity, and its peculiar influence, combined with the strange episodes with which I had been recently connected, made me morbidly wakeful and acutely sensitive. I felt that it was useless to go to bed, nor could I concentrate my mind sufficiently to read a book. I turned my lamp half down to moderate the glare, and leaning back in my chair, I gave myself up to reverie. I must have lost all perception of time, for I have no recollection how long I sat there on the borderland betwixt thought and slumber. At last, about 3 or possibly 4 o'clock, I came to myself with a start. Not only came to myself, but with every sense and nerve upon the strain. Looking round my chamber, in the dim light, I could not see anything to justify my sudden trepidation. The homely room, the rain-blurred window, and the rude wooden door were all as they had been. I had begun to persuade myself that some half-formed dream had sent that vague thrill through my nerves, when in a moment I became conscious of what it was. It was a sound. The sound of a human step outside my solitary cottage. Amid the thunder and the rain and the wind, I could hear it, a dull, stealthy footfall, now on the grass, now on the stones, occasionally stopping entirely, then resumed, and ever drawing nearer. I sat breathlessly, listening to the eerie sound. It had stopped now at my very door, and was replaced by a panting and gasping, as of one who has travelled fast and far. Only the thickness of the door separated me from this hard-breathing, light-treading night-walker. I am no coward, but the wildness of the night with the vague warning which I had had, and the proximity of this strange visitor, so unnerved me that my mouth was too dry for speech. I stretched out my hand, however, and grasped my sabre, with my eyes still bent upon the door. I prayed in my heart that the thing,
whatever it might be, would but knock or threaten or hail me or give any clue as to its character. Any known danger was better than this awful silence, broken only by the rhythmic panting. By the flickering light of the expiring lamp, I could see that the latch of my door was twitching, as though a gentle pressure were exerted on it from without. Slowly, slowly it rose, until it was free of the catch, and then there was a pause of a quarter minute or more, while I still sat silent, with dilated eyes and drawn sabre. Then, very slowly, the door began to revolve upon its hinges, and the keen air of the night came whistling through the slit. Very cautiously it was pushed open, so that never a sound came from the rusty hinges. As the aperture enlarged, I became aware of a dark, shadowy figure upon my threshold, and of a pale face that looked in at me. The features were human, but the eyes were not. They seemed to burn through the darkness with a greenish brilliancy of their own, and in their baleful, shifty glare I was conscious of the very spirit of murder. Springing from my chair, I had raised my naked sword when, with a wild shouting, a second figure dashed up to my door. At its approach, my shadowy visitant uttered a shrill cry and fled away across the fells, yelping like a beaten hound. The two creatures were swallowed up in the tempest from which they had emerged, as if they were the very genii of the beating wind and the howling rain. Tingling with my recent fear, I stood at my door, peering through the night with the discordant cry of the fugitives still ringing in my ears. At that moment a vivid flash of lightning illuminated the whole landscape and made it as clear as day. By its light I saw far away upon the hillside two dark figures pursuing each other with extreme rapidity across the fells. Even at that distance the contrast between them forbade all doubt as to their identity. The first was the small elderly man whom I had supposed to be dead. The second was my neighbour, the surgeon. For an instant they stood out clear and hard in the unearthly light. In the next, the darkness had closed over them, and they were gone. As I turned to re-enter my chamber, my foot rattled against something on my threshold. Stooping, I found it was a straight knife, fashioned entirely of lead, and so soft and brittle that it was a strange choice for a weapon. To render it the more harmless, the top had been cut square off. The edge, however, had been assiduously sharpened against a stone, as was evident from the markings upon it, so that it was still a dangerous implement in the grasp of a determined man. It had evidently dropped from the fellow's hand at the moment when the sudden coming of the surgeon had driven him to flight. There could no longer be a doubt as to the object of his visit. And what was the meaning of it all, you ask? Many a drama which I have come across in my wandering life, some as strange and as striking as this one, has lacked the ultimate explanation which you demand. Fate is a grand weaver of tales, but she ends them as a rule in defiance of all artistic laws and with an unbecoming want of regard for literary propriety. As it happens, however, I have a letter before me as I write, which I may add without comment, and which will clear all that may remain dark.
Kirby Lunatic Asylum, September the 4th, 1885. Sir, I am deeply conscious that some apology and explanation is due to you for the very startling and, in your eyes, mysterious events which have recently occurred, and which have so seriously interfered with the retired existence which you desire to lead. I should have called upon you on the morning after the recapture of my father. But my knowledge of your dislike to visitors and also of, you will excuse my saying it, your very violent temper, led me to think that it was better to communicate with you by letter. On the occasion of our last interview, I should have told you what I tell you now. But your allusions to some crime of which you considered me guilty, and your abrupt departure, prevented me from saying much that was on my lips. My poor father was a hard-working general practitioner in Birmingham, where his name is still remembered and respected. About 10 years ago, he began to show signs of mental aberration, which we were inclined to put down to overwork and the effects of a sunstroke. Feeling my own incompetence to pronounce upon a case of such importance, I at once sought the highest advice in Birmingham and London. Among others, we consulted the eminent alienist Mr. Fraser Brown, who pronounced my father's case to be intermittent in its nature, but dangerous during the paroxysms. "It may take a homicidal or it may take a religious turn," he said, "or it may prove to be a mixture of both. For months he may be as well as you or me, and then in a moment he may break out. You will incur a great responsibility if you leave him without supervision." The result showed the justice of the specialist's diagnosis. My poor father's disease rapidly assumed both a religious and homicidal turn, the attacks coming on without warning after months of sanity. It would weary you, were I to describe the terrible experiences which his family have undergone. Suffice it that, by the blessing of God, we have succeeded in keeping his poor, crazed fingers clear of blood. My sister Eva, I sent to Brussels, and I devoted myself entirely to his case. He has an intense dread of madhouses, and in his sane intervals would beg and pray so piteously not to be condemned to one that I could never find the heart to resist him. At last, however, his attacks became so acute and dangerous that I determined, for the sake of those about me, to remove him from the town to the loneliest neighbourhood that I could find. This proved to be Gaster Fell, and there he and I set up house together. I had a sufficient competence to keep me, and being devoted to chemistry, I was able to pass the time with a fair degree of comfort and profit. He, poor fellow, was as submissive as a child when in his right mind, and a better, kinder companion no man could wish for. We constructed together a wooden compartment into which he could retire when the fit was upon him, and I had arranged the window and door so that I could confine him to the house if I thought an attack was impending. Looking back, I can safely say that no possible precaution was neglected. Even the necessary table utensils were leaden and pointless to prevent his doing mischief with them in his frenzy. For months after our change of quarters, he appeared to improve. Whether it was the bracing air or the absence of any incentive to violence, he never showed during that time any signs of his terrible disorder. Your arrival first upset his mental equilibrium. The very sight of you in the distance awoke all those morbid impulses which had been sleeping. That very evening he approached me stealthily with a stone in his hand, and would have slain me, had I not, as the least of two evils, struck him to the ground and thrust him into his cage before he had time to regain his senses. This sudden relapse, naturally, plunged me into the deepest sorrow. For 2 days I did all that lay in my power to soothe him. On the third he appeared to be calmer. But alas, it was but the cunning of the madman. He had contrived to loosen 2 bars of his cage, and when thrown off my guard by his apparent improvement, I was engrossed in my chemistry, he suddenly sprang out at me, knife in hand. In the scuffle he cut me across the forearm and escaped from the hut before I recovered myself, nor could I find out which direction he had taken. My wound was a trifle, and for several days I wandered over the fells, beating through every clump of bushes in my fruitless search. I was convinced that he would make an attempt on your life, a conviction that was strengthened when I heard that someone in your absence had entered your cottage. I therefore kept a watch over you at night. A dead sheep which I found upon the moor, terribly mangled, showed me that he was not without food, and that the homicidal impulse was still strong in him. At last, as I had expected, he made his attempt upon you, which, but for my intervention, would have ended in the death of one or other of you. He ran and struggled like a wild animal, but I was as desperate as he, and succeeded in bringing him down and conveying him to the cottage. Convinced by this failure that all hope of permanent improvement is gone, I brought him next morning to this establishment, and he is now, I am glad to say, returning to his senses. Allow me once more, sir, to express my sorrow that you should have been subjected to this ordeal, and believe me to be faithfully yours, John Light Cameron. P.S. My sister Eva bids me send you her kind regards. She has told me how you were thrown together at Kirby Malhouse, and also that you met one night upon the fells. You will understand from what I have already told you that when my dear sister came back from Brussels, I did not dare to bring her home, but preferred that she should lodge in safety in the village. Even then, I did not venture to bring her into the presence of her father. And it was only at night, when he was asleep, that we could plan a meeting.
And this was the story of this strange group, whose path through life had crossed my own. From that last terrible night, I have neither seen nor heard of any of them, save for this one letter which I have transcribed. Still I dwell on Gaster Fell, and still my mind is buried in the secrets of the past. But when I wander forth upon the moor, and when I see the little grey deserted cottage among the rocks, my mind is still turned to the strange drama and to the singular couple who broke in upon my solitude. And that was The Surgeon of Gaster Fell, which appeared 130 years ago in December 1890 in Chambers' Journal. And as I said earlier, when Conan Doyle eventually reprinted this in volume form, not only had nearly 30 years elapsed, but he pruned a lot of the local detail out of the story, made it much shorter than the version that you've just heard. At the time it was originally written, Conan Doyle's father, Charles Altamont Doyle, was in one of a series of institutions that he spent many years confined in. He'd become an alcoholic and an epileptic, and the care of the family had devolved onto the shoulders of Doyle's mother. It's not clear whether Charles Doyle ever visited that area of Thornton in Lonsdale and the moors there when his wife was living there, but even the imagination of the father and the burly son, who, if Conan Doyle had a beard, he'd be rather like John Light Cameron in description. That combination of father and son must have been a difficult thing for him to write, and a more difficult thing for him to return to, perhaps, when he finally revised the story all those years later. Thank you for listening, and I hope to see you virtually or outside in London before too long.